An unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Through the mask, long minute, I'll try. I left my thinner one upstairs. So I want to talk about Martin Luther King Jr., this being his holiday weekend. And he's always been a hero of mine, and I guess of many people. And I don't know what other people have a wide range, I guess, of how we think of him. He's become an icon in a way he might not have liked particularly. You know, he is remembered for the I Have a Dream speech. You say, Martin Luther King, oh yes, I have a dream. Well, I remember him for the garbage men strike in Tennessee. And for his, you know, which is what he was supporting and actively working on when he was killed. Because he had in the later days broadened his efforts to really realizing that it wasn't only voting. There were economic disparities that needed to be addressed and so on. And is what's called his Riverside Church speech. I don't know if you are old enough to remember it or if that strikes a chord with you or not. It was on April 4th of 1967. And it was his formal declaration against the war in Vietnam. It was a lot more than that, actually, but that's how it's thought of. The title of it was Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. And he took a lot of flack for it. Why are you coming out against the war? You're a civil rights leader. You're hurting your own people. You're hurting your cause, and so on. So part of the speech was explaining why that was not a useful response, and that why he felt compelled by his faith, and I would say his politics, to speak publicly against the war. I think he'd already been talking about it a little bit for the last couple of years. And by then, by 67, the war was very unpopular, and there were already huge marches regularly. We used to live in the Hate, and the march would go by along the panhandle heading towards the Civic Center where the speeches would be. So we would just meander down the hill and join the march as it went by. And it went by for a long time. Didn't have to worry about it too much. And that actually, I didn't start living there until 68. So that was later, but still it was already very, very unpopular, and there were demonstrations. And he wanted to explain his position, and he had ideas about how to deal with it, and I'm not gonna go through it all. You can listen to it online, you can download it. It's 18, well, it's really, I guess it's 17 pages long. Long enough. And it's very powerful. The site that I downloaded it from is called American Rhetoric, an online speech bank. Mm-hmm. So it's supposed to be a speech of really, regardless of topic, I think, of really good speeches. Well, this is a really good speech. It was very powerful. And he talks a lot about this is not a phrase he uses, but about the moral imperative of speaking out, of coming forward, standing up, whatever phrase you want to use, when something is terribly wrong. He says a time that it's beyond Vietnam, but it's a time to break silence, he's saying. And in a way, what he's doing is he's challenging us. He's speaking to religious people. It's to the, where is it? Clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam. This was still back in the day when, you know, he talks about men this and men that, and man this and man that. It isn't people. That was a fight starting up the next year. and on forever, but at any rate, their statement opened with the line, "Time comes when silence is betrayal." And he says, "And that time has come for us in relation to Vietnam." And he talks about how we need to move, even though we're not 100% clear. That there's just a time when you need to speak up. Because we're always on the verge of being mesmerized by our own, by uncertainty. Because these things are always complicated. You know, we weren't the only ones committing atrocities. And he also says we must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak. And we talk about that here and there. Here, it's a question that comes up. You know, what if I'm not sure? What do I do? I'm trying to be a bodhisattva. What does that mean in this instance? Or I'm debating about setting a boundary, and what is that nice? Is that fair? Is that okay? Am I right? The humility is in order. He talks about he's speaking to us and about us. In other words, he's talking about Vietnam, but he's not addressing so much Hanoi or China or Russia or the National Liberation Front in Vietnam. You know, they were sort of too connected. There was North Vietnam, otherwise here Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh. There was also in the South, there was a National Liberation Front that was supported by the North, but more indigenous to the South. And as he grew up, as he points out, he says, I'm talking to my fellow Americans because I love this country. And he says, since I'm a preacher by calling, I suppose it's not surprising that I have seven major reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of my moral vision. I don't know why seven reasons has to do with being a preacher, but okay. And he was, you know, you forget sometimes until you listen to him or read his speeches. He was also quite a scholar, you know, and he's always quoting ancient philosophers and scholars, you know, not necessarily Christian. So he, one of the things was that, you know, Johnson had the war on poverty. And it had a great start, and then pretty soon, because Johnson became president on November 22nd, 1963, the day Kennedy was assassinated, just in case. And this was in April of 67. So that was towards the end of Johnson's term. I guess he was elected on his own in 64. He ran against Barry Goldwater and won by a landslide. But by 67, the war was taking more and more resources, and the anti-poverty programs were hemorrhaging funds, and how that's one of his reasons for opposing the war. So he saw the war as an enemy of the poor. It's not a humble way to say it, but at any rate. And then he realized too that people of color were disproportionately being drafted and being killed in Vietnam. And he worried about what it was doing to the younger generation, seeing their own country using bombs and napalm and so on, in order to bring peace to others. And the hypocrisy of that was troubling, to say the least. That he said that he felt he couldn't, he would meet young men and, you know, they would talk about nonviolence, and they'd say, "What? What nonviolence? We're using violence to bring peace." So he said he could never again raise his voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in this world today, my own government. Cannot be silent. And then people, he says, you know, people, he addresses it directly to people, say, "You're a civil rights leader, why are you doing this? This isn't your bailiwick." they mean to exclude me from the movement for peace. And he points to the SCL, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, his organization. Their motto was, or is, I guess, to save the soul of America. And he points out that America would never be free and never be able to save itself until we address the slaves and the descendants of the slaves until we address, he doesn't say it exactly, but until we address the wound that racism and slavery represent. And he quotes Langston Hughes, who wrote, "Oh yes, I say it plain, America never was America for me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be." You know, it reminds me of Doc Rivers. Does everybody know who Doc Rivers is? Yes, they know. He's a very famous basketball coach and a wonderful man. And I think it was around the time of the murder, whatever. Basketball fans know what I'm talking about. Anyway, he said, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "I don't know. We love you, America, but you never love us back. You never love us back. America will be." So he came as led down the path of protest and dissent, working for the health of our land. And he mentions the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, that he had won in 54, and that was a commission and maybe an admonition to work even harder for peace and justice. And that his work, in his terms, is to be a good son and brother of Christ and God, and to work for all beings, all people, including communists. And he says, "What then can I say to the Viet Cong or to Castro or to Mao as a faithful minister of this one? Can I threaten them with death? Or must I share with them my life?" There's a good bodhisattva line. And then he talks with some detail about some of our hypocrisy. He says, you know, to find real healing, we have to listen to our enemies, those we don't want to listen to. We have to try to see the conflict from their side and not just our own, and see clearly. And I think that's, for me, that's a major practice. And I talk to the lawyers about this a lot, about being able to see the whole case, the strengths of yours, but also the weaknesses of yours, and the weakness of the other side, but also their strengths, and to be able to really listen to your client and opposing counsel say. And that's always the case. And that's what we lose sight of often in our day-to-day life when we're arguing with someone, is particularly somebody close by. Do we speak our own truth? Do we speak our own truth in a way that can be heard? I often suggest to people that if they're hurt by something, they try just saying, "Ouch, ouch," You know, you don't have to say, fuck you. You don't have to say, no, you're wrong. You never listen to me. No. Just say, ouch. That hurt. What would that be like? If you're willing to be vulnerable enough and open enough to just say, ouch. So he thinks about the people in Vietnam, both North and South. He says that they must see Americans as strange liberators. And then he goes through a little history, you know, how they were a French colony and then freed themselves at the end of World War II. And then the French started to fight to recolonize, and apparently I didn't know this, we funded it. It got to the point where we were paying for 80% of it, and the French really kind of wanted out, and we were paying at some point almost all of it. And the French in Dien Bien Phu finally lost and left. So then we took it up. And there were some peace accords, but we violated them. And we installed the first of a series of really cruel dictators. Here is the true meaning and value of compassion and nonviolence. When it helps us to see the enemy's point of view, to hear his questions, to know his assessment of ourselves. For from his view, we may indeed see the basic weaknesses of our own condition. And if we are mature, we may learn and grow and profit from the wisdom of the brothers who are called the opposition. So he makes a very strong case. You can read it. I'm not here to rehash the Vietnam War. And he says, in talking about our hypocrisy, he's at least as concerned about our own soldiers, because what they're learning is not only killing someone, but they're learning cynicism, because they get over there and then they see that we don't seem to be fighting about for what we say we're fighting about. And so they come home and they've been kind of, I don't know what the word I would use them, maybe corrupted. Not corrupted in the sense that they're going to go out and be greedy or steal or whatever. But their idea of America has taken a big hit. And of course, you know that, you know, one of the things that hurt them the most was when they came home, people didn't greet them as heroes by any means. So he quotes, he says, this is the message of the great Buddhist leaders of Vietnam. Recently, one of them wrote these words, and I quote, and I imagine it's Thich Nhat Hanh, but he doesn't say. Each day the war goes on, the hatred increases in the heart of the Vietnamese and in the hearts of those of humanitarian instinct. The Americans are forcing even their friends into becoming their enemies. It is curious that the Americans, who calculate so carefully on the possibilities of military victory, do not realize that in the process they are incurring deep psychological and political defeat. The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy, but the image of violence and militarism. And we do suffer from that image. So, he has some ideas about how to deal with the conflict, but then he goes on to say, and we need to deal with the deeper malady, this Okay, actually, I mean, you could say racism, but it's beyond racism. It's this us, them, me, mine, you, mine. So if we don't deal with the deeper malady, we're going to find ourselves having a concern religious leaders on Guatemala and Peru, Thailand, Cambodia, Mozambique and South Africa, and so on and on and on. So that we need to address this, self-regard leading us to be on the wrong side of history. And we and our individuals, us here, we need to address our self-regard. Quotes, a sensitive American official overseas said that to him it seemed that our nation was on the wrong side of a world revolution. Kennedy said, those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. King says we have to undergo a radical revolution of values from a thing-oriented to a person-oriented society. And it is sad that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. And he says that the answer is love, not that some sentimental and weak response. I'm not speaking of that force, which is just emotional bosh. Yes. I'm speaking of the force of which all the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. He says it's summed up in the first epistle of St. John. Let us love one another, for love is God, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us. King says, let us hope this spirit will become the order of the day. So he's talking about agape kind of love, selfless. That's bodhisattva love. That's another one. We have a choice: nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. Violent co-annihilation. So, oops. I think he's challenging us to take ourselves seriously, to take our vows seriously. You know, we just about to chant, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Whatever that means. And we each, I think, need to look into our own hearts. Sit with that question of what is it for me? No, we're not Martin Luther King Jr. And we can still learn from him and be inspired by him and take his words into our own hearts and vow to save The six ancestors said, save all the little beings in each of us, all my little beings of greed and hate and delusion, jealousy and anger and so on. And in that way, save other beings. To make their lives easier when I'm not so reactive. When I can say ouch instead of retaliating. And then whatever that leads you to do with your time is for you to decide. Even King had, you know, he had to have time off. So I'm not saying that everybody should go out and vow a life of poverty and do nothing but care for others until you kill yourself. That's not what I'm saying, and I don't think that's what he's saying. He liked bourbon. Good man, liked bourbon. I started to say, I like bourbon, and I realized I sounded like Kavanaugh. I like beer. Anyway, let's spend some time this weekend being with him, letting him be with you, and remembering that he was a complicated person and that his commitment was deep and wide and not simply, I have a dream. Wonderful as that speech was, there's more to him. So I'm already over time, and so I'm going to stop, and we can all talk about this another time.
Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I